I'll keep starving until I'm 80, 90 years old. Food is such a beautiful thing. It's like languages. You're never going to learn every language in the world, just like you won't learn every single dish in the world. So I'm so eager to learn absolutely everything about food.
Today on Dirty Linen, we are heading all the way over to New York City to talk to Chef Buddha Low. I've known Buddha for ages since he lived in Melbourne, and it's been a real thrill to watch his star continue to shine. Buddha at the moment is starring on Top Chef, a fantastic dynamic cooking show. This season's in Houston, Texas. Buddha, welcome to Dirty Linen.
Thank you, Danny. Look forward to being on it.
Well, it's happening. Here you are. As I said, you know, I've been so excited to watch all the different things that you've done. But let's start with what you're doing now on Top Chef, which is screening here on Hayu. Tell us about the experience of being on the show.
So being on a competition, especially on TV, has always been one of my dreams. And unfortunately in Australia, we don't actually have a professional cooking show, competition. So being on one is absolutely incredible. It's something that I've always wanted to do. It's not so much for the fame or any of the other sort of stuff, the prizes. It's purely just because I love cooking. And it's one of the best things to do is just be like, this side of cooking is actually really fun. The competition side, where all you have to do is think about the food, whereas in a normal restaurant life, you would have to think about food cost, how am I going to get people working Instagram, how am I going to get people to this, you know, this night market or something like that. Whereas when you're into these challenges, everything's organized for you. So it's like a dream. All I have to do is rock up and cook. So it's great being able to just think about food and not have to think about all the other different surfaces that you have to cover just to make a successful cooking operation happen.
What's the standard like? I mean, is it intimidating? I mean, and you've got some, you know, incredible guest judges and hosts, Tom Colicchio. There's so many big names there. Like, what's it like in that arena?
Yeah, the standard's huge. Is we have, you know, some big name chefs, and what's great about the cooking competition is that they don't just highlight Michelin background chefs, where you know you have some people that are that have a lot of strength from the southern cooking, and then you got, you know, chef like Luke that's actually been at Noma for the last 8 years, and Monique that's also worked at Geranium in Copenhagen, and Le Doyen in Paris. So it's a huge variety and range of chefs that have a lot of huge skills, and it's what's great about the challenges is that it's not a Michelin star challenge every time. You could be asked to do something very simple and basic, and sometimes in this industry, especially in the Michelin star category industry, not all chefs have that skill to be able to produce a nice staff meal or family meal that we call it here, or something very simple. Some simple cookery. Some people just go through these Michelin star ranks and they know how to sear a perfect foie gras or, you know, pan fry or sous vide that fish perfectly, but they won't know how to make a real authentic curry or something like that. So that's what's very interesting about this sort of cooking competition.
I saw on the showreel like there was a bit of an alligator challenge. Can you tell us about that?
Unfortunately, Danny, that episode hasn't aired yet, so I can't say too much about the alligator.
The alligator mystery remains.
You have to tune into Hey You and watch that episode and find out.
No worries. So, I mean, it's interesting, you know, if one of my earliest encounters with you was at a young chef competition here in Melbourne. I mean, what place has competitions played in your career?
Competitions have been huge. I actually started doing that when I was in high school, and I started doing these little competitions that we do at the shopping center in Cairns. There were like dessert static display, cooking a fish. And like, I remember all these dishes and they were like, looking back at it and where it is, where I'm at now, very happy with how far I've came, but the competitions have they've played a huge critical role in my life just because and career, because that really ignited a lot of creativity into the way that I cook. And doing it at such a young age, I think I just grew this sort of like, I don't really care if I win or lose. I'm just going to keep entering it. And I've definitely lost a lot and won a few, but there's only one winner in it at the end of the day. So I learned tremendous amounts of even one of the challenges that I won a scholarship to go to France. It wasn't Paris, it's Paris now, but it was a Thierry Marx scholarship that runs in Melbourne every year, and an apprentice gets to go to France and work at a 2-Michelin-star restaurant. That's something that I got to do, and that was such an eye-opener into Michelin-star restaurants. My first Michelin-star restaurant that I worked in, and I was 17 years old. I was in the middle of France, in Pauillac. So it wasn't even – so you go to France, you go to Paris, and then you get on a train, then you have to go 4 hours to Bordeaux, and then you have to get even another train from Bordeaux to 1.5 hours into this vineyard that's a small town of probably about 800 people, and no one speaks English. So that was definitely out of my comfort zone, but it was so rewarding, and it definitely impacted my life and made me really just signify that I want to do this going forward.
What kinds of things did you see there? Was it the produce? Was it the technique? Was it the way the kitchen worked? You know, what really lit you up?
Oh, it was just the culture of it, the passion that the chefs had. Like it was, we'd start at 7:30 in the morning and finish at 12, but some people might go, oh, that's a lot, it's too much. But I was in there and I was just like in awe, and I loved it all. And I love that sort of drive. And that was the sort of place that I wanted to be surrounded, be in, and the people that I want to be surrounded by. So I really strived in those sort of areas. Yeah, there was a lot of things that happened. That's very old school French. You know, there was a lot of yelling, maybe even a slight bit of racism here and there. But I loved every single moment of it. And like I said, the produce, like you said before, the produce was just outstanding. Something that you'd like never see before. The strawberries are treated like these VIP strawberries, where when they come in these little boxes, and then we have to lay them out individually on these trays, making sure there's gaps so they're not touching each other. It's a complete different world. But I've worked in these areas of different parts of the world. I've been to Singapore, I staged in Copenhagen, France, worked in London, worked in New York, and going through that, it's just what's amazing about it is that everyone's got all these different ways of the culture of the kitchen. So it's amazing to see what I can try and come up with, seeing all these different cultures and seeing what sort of culture I'd like to bring into my own.
Yeah, it's really interesting, you know, looking at your career. You know, you started at your family's restaurant in North Queensland. You cooked in Melbourne at restaurants including Hare and Grace and Matteo's. You were a head chef at Hare and Grace when you were just 19. You know, went over to London, worked at restaurant Gordon Ramsay, went over and staged and got a job at 11 Madison Park. Now you're head chef at Marquis Caviar and Huso, another fine dining restaurants in New York City. When I look at everything that you've done, it just feels like you're the absolute paragon of that guy who takes every opportunity that you can from a career in the kitchen. It's, you know, everything that people say about the good things about being a chef, you know, you get to travel, you get to try different things, you know, the world is literally your oyster. It just feels like you've just seized every opportunity. Is that how it's felt like for you?
100%. Ever since I fell in love with cooking and watched my dad when I was 12 years old, I just kind of just followed whatever my passion felt like. I had always had a direction on where I was going to go, but it always happened in the moment. I knew the moment that I needed to leave Matteo's to go work with Raymond, because I knew that I wanted to work for Raymond. So it's just, I don't know why or how, it just, in my mind, it made a lot of sense to me. And moving to New York was one of those opportunities, and my visa was about to expire, and I was like, well, what do I go back to Australia, or do I try and see if I can get a person, an employer to sponsor me so I can stay into the country? And then those sort of opportunities obviously led to where I'm now. And you know, I got asked to be on Top Chef, and I got to compete on that. So it's just another one of those things where it feels like a bit of luck, but it's also a lot of persistence as well.
Yeah, and obviously you've had important mentors during your career that have really seen something in you. I mean, I remember Raymond Capaldi, you know, a European trained chef here, you know, bit of an old school guy in the kitchen, from my understanding, watching him across the past, like, you know, it doesn't hold back if he feels like something needs to be said. But I also remember how almost like, you know, fatherly he was towards you, and quite tender, and obviously really saw something special in you. I mean, how you said you make those decisions in the moment, or things just feel right. Like, how have you made those decisions? Like, what, how do you know when something feels right?
Well, when I first encountered Raymond, it didn't seem like that was going to be the path that I was going to go. It was a terrible night. I got yelled at a lot, and I was working at Mateo's, and eventually, you know, I said to myself, I'm going to wipe this off, and I'm going to come back in tomorrow, and I'm going to go twice as hard. And that's what I did. And I think Raymond saw that in me, and he turned around one day and he said, if you come with me, you're going to go far. And everyone who was in the kitchen, especially the apprentices, they all just almost kind of snapped their necks, because they all turned around as like, who's this guy? Out of all the people in the kitchen, you want to take this guy with you? Like, this guy's going down every day. And I think Raymond saw something in there, and I didn't know the severity of it, of how huge of a chef he was and is. And I knew that I had to learn under him. And thankfully I did, because I learned a lot from Raymond. A lot of people can see him at the molecular forefront at that time, but he was very classically trained, and he drilled that into me, not just the way he worked, it was the way that he was to cook. And I think I learned a lot of fundamentals and foundations of cooking through him.
Mm. It's really interesting seeing what Raymond's doing now. He's got Wonder Pies and Baked Tico. So he's really taken those foundations that he himself has and turned them into something completely different, much more mass market and accessible. I think he sort of looks back on some of those Hare and Grace dishes, which were very refined. There was, you know, quite a bit of kitchen trickery. I think, you know, he's left those things behind, but I guess he's instilled in people such as yourself the skills and the wherewithal to take some of those techniques and that approach onward.
Yeah, of course. It's a beauty of the industry is that you can take your career into a sort of place that you want it to be, especially at the time of your life. Of course, I don't expect Raymond to be in that sort of environment for the rest of his life. And you know, he's a lot happier now, and I'm really happy for what he's doing. We keep in touch. You know, like you said before, he is a fatherly figure. When something's going down, he's the first person to call, and he'll call me constantly and make sure that I'm all good. And it'll be like times at like Hare and Grace where I'd be finishing maybe 3 hours after he's completely done anything to do with the kitchen, and he'll just wait for me in the office to go drive me from the CBD to Carlton because he just wants to drop me off at home. So it's a lot of these sort of things that he did for me that really kind of nurtured me and looked after me, and which was really amazing to be a part of, because I don't think a lot of people get that opportunity. He's such a heavy hitter in the culinary world, and the fact that you have someone like that of that caliber really taking interest in and nurturing you is something that you don't really get nowadays. You have huge chefs like I can say in New York, like Thomas Keller, Daniel Ballou, maybe even Eric Repair. I don't really know to that extent, but I can imagine that most of the chefs aren't really going to be learned or trained underneath these sort of chefs who have their names on the door. It's going to be a CDC. For example, my training was at Restaurant Gordon Ramsay, but that was under Claire Smith and Matt Abbe. So I never, as much as I like to say that I work for Gordon Ramsay, I really didn't. I worked for Claire. I worked for Matt. And that's a very special moment that they have, because they have actually worked with Gordon. And that's why Matt and Claire are where they are at today, because of working directly underneath this chef. So I was very lucky to work for Raymond, for sure.
I know you've got really strong views on kitchen culture, and it's interesting to hear you talk about, you know, some of the long hours that you've experienced, you know, racial abuse, that you have been yelled at a lot, and yet you've been able to turn those things into, I guess, fuel for your own fire. But do you think it's okay that people are treated like that in kitchens?
No, I don't think it's okay. Like, it was never okay, but for some reason it was okay, and it was really okay, like even the generations before. And that sort of culture is not sustainable. Still, even with like the way that it is now, a lot of things aren't sustainable in the kitchen and in the hospitality world. So no, moving forward, I don't take on those traits. I don't believe people should be working those sort of hours, and I don't believe people should be treated like that either. And at the end of the day, I'd like to put it out there. No one really put a gun to your head and said you need to open a restaurant. So if you can't afford your cooks, and if you need them to work, you know, for free, overtime, and, you know, abuse them, like, don't do it. Just don't open a restaurant. No one told you that you had to, so don't do it. So moving forward, the advice for like people that want to open a restaurant, do everything properly. And I know it's easier to say than do, but that's the reality of it. No one forced you to open a restaurant, so just make sure you do everything properly. And that's just something that I would love that I'm gonna do. And I don't own a restaurant yet. But that's something that I'm going to make sure that I do if I ever open a restaurant in the future, is just to make sure that it's done correctly.
Mm. I mean, how do you reconcile, you know, proper working conditions with that excellence and that deep learning that you've done, you know, which partly at least has to do with the extreme conditions that you worked under?
So I found that when I worked in these extreme conditions, there was a lot of things that and that could have been done more smarter. Like, I feel like most of the stuff that I did when I was in training, there was a lot of things that were thrown out and made fresh every day. Like, that, especially in these real 3 Michelin star restaurants, I feel like a sauce can at least have, you know, a little bit more shelf life than one day. I feel that also that the industry not only has to mold to this sort of way of I'm just trying to structure the words. We have to mold into this sort of new place that we're going to. For example, wage is high. We need to cut down on wage. But how do we cut down on that? Well, we're going to do things that, you know, if we look back at the restaurants that were in the 2000s, there's probably about 15 to 20 garnishes on a plate. No one told you to put 15 to 20 garnishes on there. And that is like one full employee just making those garnishes. Nowadays, food's a lot more simple and minimalistic, and you can make more impact by taking those steps. So it's all about changing the cuisine and the style of how we used to cook. Because if we look back when in the old school days where French was all the hype and we're doing 15 dots and running our skewer and making towers of everything, that doesn't exist anymore because we can't afford to have that sort of labor into one dish. So I think in the future, moving forward is just that we have to change, and cuisine is going to change. But no matter what we do, it's going to be great anyway. So it's all about working smarter, not harder, and also making sure that we're doing food that's capable for the team. I think our restaurant in Port Douglas, it's a Chinese restaurant. It had maybe about 70 different items. My dad passed away, and now it's probably down to maybe 25 items. That was not sustainable for my dad. He worked 7 days. He would prep, from 10 o'clock in the morning and finish at 11 o'clock at night, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. That's not how it should work anymore. He had to cut down the menu, which they did, and now it operates much more easier because now we just take out we make sure that we have all the popular items on there, and now it functions easier. My mom and my brother have 2 days off a week, which is like the first time for them in maybe about 15 plus years. So it's the way forward.
Yeah, I love what you're saying, Buddha. It's so thought provoking. I mean, it really makes me think that, you can look at a plate of food and have wonder, is this plate ethical? Like, is each dot, representing someone's labor that perhaps could have been used in a different way? And I guess, I guess we look at plates of food and we think, we think about nose to tail or root to tip or whatever it is. But I think we can also look at plates of food and think about labor and I guess ego as well. It's like how possible is it for chefs to still be working at an extremely high level and to be very satisfied and to feel creative, but to strip it back and think about the different kinds of stories that you can tell with a dish.
Exactly. Yeah, you really highlighted it. Yep.
Yeah, no, so interesting. Well, tell me how it works at Markey's, which is caviar focused. Like, even though that's a luxury ingredient, is that somewhere on the path to where you think things should go?
So, yes, in a way, because I'm constantly working with luxurious ingredients. Not am I only using caviar, but I'm also using, some of the best pork in the world, some of the, tuna from Spain, some of the best tuna that's, hand spiked in the water. Like, it, and I'm using caviar, and I feel like my dishes are really simple, yet I just focus on presentation and technique rather than trying to do too much to it, because that's not what you want to do. And I think caviar is like this perfect ingredient where you don't want to outshine it. So when you work with quality produce, it's kind of like the Italian mentality of cooking. You don't have to do too much to it. And that's what I do. So in that sense, at Markey's, we do 12 people a night, 4 nights a week. We do 1 day of prep. And I used to do all this by myself. We actually hired a cook, not too long ago, so I can do other things, but it's all managed by one cook. We do eight courses a night. The menu changes seasonally, and they're able to do all this by themselves and pull it off, do the whole service by themselves as well. So it's all about putting these smarter techniques into place to make sure that you don't need extra hands, because we're in New York, and to find extra space in kitchen or the dining room is very hard. So you have to get creative and really understand and be thoughtful about how you can manipulate that space into something that you want. And I found that the last couple of years that I'm able to do that quite easily.
Interesting, because a lot of Australian kitchens are small as well, but perhaps space isn't at such a premium as it is in a city like New York. I also wonder, customers obviously have to come to the party and be prepared to pay the true cost of dining. Can you compare New York to Australia in that sense?
Yeah, of course. New York is, of course, more expensive than Australia. My menu runs about $225 per person, and that's not including gratuity. Our gratuity is 20% on top, and then tax as well on top of that. So you're almost looking about $300 American per person. But in my restaurant, it's a little bit different. We are using caviar, and caviar is not the cheapest ingredient, especially to do with eight courses. So at the end of the day, it is a bit of a bargain. But in New York, yeah, I think the dining scene here is so great, and there's a lot of people that want to come here and eat. And I think, yeah, the price tag does come with it. The everything to try and execute in New York is very hard. Labor cost, rent is huge here. The produce, just because it's so hard for just purveyors to get around New York. It's very hard to get things that are affordable. So the prices go up. And I think for most part, people are okay with it. But I'm in a bit of a lucky position because I only do 50 covers a week. So for the most part, my dining room's booked out, because out of the whole of New York, there's surely going to be 50 people that would like to spend an anniversary or a special dinner or a special occasion. So I'm quite lucky with that. But for the most part, yeah, I think most people get on with paying for the prices. Yeah.
What's a dish that you're loving making at the moment?
It's like for me, I think all the dishes that I do, I fall in love with. I don't really put a dish that I don't love. But I would say the one thing that probably comes up to mind is that I haven't done a lot of Mexican cookery, and I've just did a tres leches on the menu, and it's a cake that's been soaked in three different kinds of milk. And I find that very interesting with the caviar, and it looks stunning as well. It's for the, I found this mold that makes it look like the shape of a rose. So it's like a white rose, and it's heavily inspired by spring. And the caviar works really well with the milk, which is a kind of like the dairy aspect of how you would have caviar, like creme fraiche, and then the cake being more like the blini pancake. And then there's a dulce de leche, which brings that salted caramel aspect when it's eaten with the caviar. So it's a simple dish, very easy, very simply presented. But yeah, I think that dish does come to mind.
That's just blown my mind, because like, it's sweet, but it's with caviar. But the way that you describe it, I guess it does make sense, because we do love a little bit of salt to liven up a sweet dish. And I guess, yeah, the whole, you know, popping pearl kind of thing, that we've seen that on dessert. So I guess it's definitely intriguing. I would love to taste that. How interesting.
Yeah, and that's what's really, I'm really lucky with. I get to work with this a quality product, and Marquis is a purveyor of fine food, so they deal with all the best ingredients in the world. So I'm really lucky to be a part of that.
Buddy, you said that being on a cooking competition show was one of your dreams. Have you got any unfulfilled other dreams that you can tell us about?
Yeah, I want to. It's kind of like why I'm still here as well. I want to get 3 Michelin stars. So there's no Michelin stars in Australia, and it's something that I really want to achieve in my lifetime.
Wow, you are aiming high.
Yeah. I'm here, and I'm trying to make that dream happen, and I feel like whenever there's a goal that's fulfilled, there's always another goal after it. So I'm at this part of my life where I'd like to continue whatever is happening. I think I'm on the right path right now.
Wow, that's really, really good to hear. I love hearing that confidence and optimism in your voice. Buddha, what advice would you give to young chefs who are starting out or in the early stage of their careers?
Of course, there's one thing that I was taught, is just that you've got like 4 things that you really need as a chef, and it's passion, commitment, dedication. And those are the 3. And if you have all 3 of them, you'll have the last one, which is skill. And those 4 things will really make a great chef. Those are like the 4 qualities that you really, really need to get through it. And if you have all those, then the world's your oyster. If you're constantly eager to learn, don't neglect any information. Like I've said this before, I'll keep staging until I'm 80, 90 years old. I food is such a beautiful thing. It's like languages. You're never going to learn every language in the world, just like you won't learn every single dish in the world. So I'm so eager to learn absolutely everything about food. And I hope that whoever's deciding to join this industry, hopefully they enjoy the ride, and hopefully this industry can make the turn for the better. And I hope, and so when people are trying to get into this career, they're nurtured and they love what they do, because that's what's the most important thing, is that if you love what you do, especially where you work, you're going to have a great life.
And it sounds like, you know, it's perhaps not to put words into your mouth, but it sounds like you also believe people shouldn't be afraid to make big changes.
Oh, absolutely not. I think the number one thing that I learned from Gordon Ramsay is to always make sure that you're in, out of your comfort zone. That's where you're going to learn the most. So, yeah, I encourage everyone to do it for sure.
It sounds kind of scary, but also exciting.
Yes, it is. But once you know the results from being out of your comfort zone, like every single restaurant that I've been in, I've wanted to quit, and I just overcame it and, you know, found out that, you know, all those sort of things that people, you'd find, oh, that's a bit offensive. I mean, they're doing it because they care for you. I find that the people that aren't really aren't getting like the training, I feel like the most of the mentors have kind of given up a bit. So it's all about taking everything on board and keep your ears open and learn a lot. And yeah, just don't worry about making it big so early. I did that, and it was kind of like not a regret, but it was kind of an eye opener, especially when I was at Mateo's. I was head chef, and there's a lot of things happening, and it was really good. I was getting awards, and, you know, we'll make it onto all these like great lists and stuff like that. And I was 25, and I was like, I need to go back into another kitchen and learn again. So I think the thing is to not try and rush it, because if you want to be this head chef at 21, 24, it's like, well, you can do that for the rest of your life. But being on the station and learning how to cook or working for great chefs, it's not a very long time if you look at it. Most chefs become head chefs around 30. And if you start your apprenticeship at 18, you've only really been cooking for 12 years. And all those sort of things that you learn in those 12 years are going to be the things that you carry on for the rest of your life. So if you're going to only be cooking for 4 years and then become a head chef at 22, well, that's all you got. So don't try and rush it. Make sure that you put in the work and try and learn as much as you can before you get into a higher position.
Love it, Buddha. So great to catch up with you. Congratulations on all that you've achieved and all that you will continue to do. Good luck with Top Chef. Wrangle that alligator.
Thanks, Danny. I hope you guys stay tuned to it. I need some Australian support, that's for sure.
For sure. we'll keep an eye on you and stay in touch. Great to chat.
Thanks, Danny.
This is Dirty Linen, and I'm Danny Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta @dirtylinenpodcast. We can't wait to hear from you. This.